It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at the future of the Milwaukee Bucks franchise after yesterday's proposed sale of the team.
But first, voting rights and election access have been in the news lately, with Wisconsin's voter ID laws hung up in the courts and talk of a special legislative session to tweak those rules after the courts rule. There are similar laws in court cases around the country, and in the last week, President Obama and other Democrats have made Election Day access a major talking point.
Our Central Time historian says arguments over voting rights and poll access have a long history here in the United States. Jonathan Pollack is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College, and he joins us each month to put a current news item in historical context.
John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Before we dig into the history, do we take voting as seriously now as we did historically, do you think?
Well, I think it's one of those things that goes through ebbs and flows. If you look at, say, voting in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, it was intense and serious to the point of being downright scary. Elections were often accompanied by torchlight campaigns. When we go back to like the 1840 election.
No, when you say torchlight campaigns, these are kind of menacing torchlight
yeah,
campaigns.
So it's nighttime and it's the 1840s. There's no streetlights yet. So you've got people marching around with torches in the darkness. And I'm thinking in particular here of like the William Henry Harrison campaign in 1840, the Tippecanoe and Tyler II thing, which was kind of, in some ways kind of the first modern political campaign. And so you've got people marching around by torchlight, and you've got their supporters loaded up on hard cider and rot gut booze.
It's kind of like the Final Four.
Yeah, drunken torchlight parades. Yeah, kind of. Probably a few couches were burnt in the process. Davenports, they would have been called then, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So there are these torchlight parades that would go on. Arguments between people of different political persuasions, between the Whigs and Democrats at that point, or Democrats and Republicans in the years to come.
So the whole concept of political divisiveness.
Yeah, so the divisiveness would be there, and people would follow it up with fists.
Really?
we complain about the overheated rhetoric of the president, and where is the bipartisan sentiment, and so forth. But, people actually duking it out on the floor of the state legislature is less common than it used to be. So, elections, I think, have gone through periods of time where, number one, there's intense activity. And there's really, when we look at the development even of political gangs in many cities, they began as auxiliaries of political parties or of different factions of a party designed to sort of turn out the vote and suppress physically people from turning out and voting. When we go back to that, we can say, people took it a lot more seriously. But there are also periods of great voter apathy, of times where, we get maybe 60% of the population actually turns out to vote in a presidential election. So in some ways, other historians, other pundits and observers have talked about in a lot of ways the U.S. is going back to the 1890s. And one of them, I think, is maybe with the seriousness of elections, that voting and so forth was so long kind of being worked up about voting was kind of the province of social studies teachers in high schools who would try to encourage people to vote. And now people are really kind of paying attention to it. It's becoming a much more alive issue.
So why do you think that's the case? I mean, historically, why was that the case?
Well, I think there are different reasons historically. When we're talking about going back to like 1840, for example. So 1840 elections are one where in most parts of the country, the only people who are voting are going to be white males. So you've got a reduced electorate, but you've got a sense that the stakes are really high. There was a lot of social activity wrapped up in voting, that you had social clubs that were tied to one party or another or a faction of a party in a big city. And so voting was part of your gang, part of your people that you hung out with on a regular basis. Later on, when we talk about voting after the Civil War, when blacks had been when slavery was gone, when blacks had been emancipated and were able to vote, then you get the same kind of conflict reoccurs in southern states where white vigilante mobs tried to ensure that even though blacks had the right to vote, they would not go and exercise it. So there are, it's a recurring kind of intensity, a recurring kind of like mob activity. And in the present, I think in many cases there's a phrase, you don't miss what you have until it's gone. You don't miss your water until the well runs dry and so forth. And voting, I think, is one of the things that people took for granted for a long time, that the trend Really, up until about 10 years ago, the trend was to make voting easier and easier. States like Oregon began, voting online. More states adopted Wisconsin's model of same-day registration and voting to simplify that process. States expanded the possible hours that you could vote in person early. More people applied for absentee ballots, and the process of getting an absentee ballot was easier. And then within the last 10 years, that's been kind of rolled back. And when people are accustomed to something that's really easy, you know, and it's kind of taken away from them, they sit up and they pay attention a little bit and they say, wait, what's going on here? And they get kind of agitated.
So we'd like you to join the conversation too. If you're riled up about voting or thinking about it a lot more these days, like a lot of people are, you can join the conversation, and we can also put a historical spin on it as well with our guest. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. What do you think is a key issue related to election laws these days? Do you have concerns about that? Would you like some historical perspective on it? Any questions about election history in the U.S. are open right now. The number is 800-642-1234. And you kind of alluded to this at one point, but you've said that at one point white males were the only people who could vote. There also was a situation where you had to own land to do that, right? Too?
Yeah, that was earlier. By the time of the Civil War, states had gotten rid of the land ownership requirement. So that was an expansion of voting. And certainly by the 1828 election that brought Andrew Jackson in, a lot of the people who voted for Andrew Jackson were not big landholders, mm-hmm. as would have been the case before. But yeah, coupled with the liberalization of voting and the expansion of voting, beginning in the 1860s and 1870s, Southern state governments began enacting piecemeal changes to the voting process, additional requirements that made it harder for many people to vote, in particular, made it harder for African Americans to vote. So it's also, I mean, the experience of the period from like 1865, 1870 on through about 1900 is an important idea that I stress in the classes I teach in history quite a bit, is we often see this kind of lowercase p progressive vision of history where people get more rights over time, and that's pretty much a one-way slope. But actually, it's kind of a back and forth.
It's like a wave. You know,
it's a wave, right. Exactly, that there are times where rights are expanded and then rights get taken away and people have to fight to expand the rights, and it goes back and forth. So the restrictions undertaken in the late 19th century, what's fascinating about them is that due to the constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War, as a way of getting around those and trying to reestablish facts on the ground as they existed before the Civil War, where only whites could vote, the laws in some ways sound – they're in line with other practices in the United States. They seem innocuous, but when taken together – and with the additional factor of just outright intimidation that could exist,
right.
They had a very strong effect on restricting the number of blacks who could vote. That, for example, in Louisiana from 1890 to 1900, the number of black voters simply evaporates. By 1890, something like 5% of blacks in the state of Louisiana are able to vote.
It's not because they're gone. It's because of these
rules. Right. It's because there were still the same number of people there and more people there. But no, their ability to vote was hampered by poll taxes, by charging people a tax to vote, creating what were called by creating literacy tests were a huge part of it. I mean, both of these on their face, you know, we often charge people for things that they don't do. We don't require people to vote in the United States. We don't require people to hunt. So sure, if you want to hunt, take out a hunting license and take out as many as you want, depending on what you hunt. And so by that political theory, it makes sense. Oh, we don't have to vote. If you want to vote, if you're like me and you vote all the darn time, great. Go and take out a permit for that. And if not, you know, save yourself a few bucks. In practice, what that because the widespread nature of black poverty in the late 19th century, many people didn't have the extra few bucks to vote. That was a huge burden to come up with a few dollars to pay for the poll tax. Additionally, I hear literacy tests. People talk about this all the time. You know, an election comes up they don't like, and people say, stupid people are voting. That's the problem here. We should have some kind of test
right.
where people have to know. They have to be like Wisconsin public radio listeners. They have to be up on things. They have to know what's what in order to vote. Why can't we just do that? Well, we tried that in the 19th century, and the problem was that the states never defined what literacy was, and the counties never defined it. They said, oh, we've got a county clerk who can determine those things. He or she will know. They'll be able to test if someone's literate or not. So in case after case, when white voters came in to register, especially if the person as the clerk knew them, they just said, oh, well, you graduated high school ahead of me. I know you know how to read and write. We're not going to test you. When black voters came in, they faced much steeper examples of literacy tests.
So we're talking about elections with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison College, about the history of voting rights and voting access in the United States. We do have a number of calls that we'll go to in just a minute, and you can join the conversation as well.
What do you make of the current debate over voter ID, and what Election Day issues are on your mind? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org.
We'll go to the phones in just a minute, but first, a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
President Barack Obama says the U.S. and its allies are waiting to see if Russia follows through on an agreement reached today in Geneva about the crisis in Ukraine. Speaking at the White House, Obama says he hopes Russia will honor its promises about intervention in the former Soviet state. If not, he says Moscow will face additional sanctions. A new government report says the Internal Revenue Service audits less than 1% of large partnerships. That's according to the Government Accountability Office. It says the number of large businesses organized as partnerships has more than tripled since 2002, yet hardly any get close to scrutiny by the IRS. Governor Scott Walker has declared another propane emergency. Midwestern states have been grappling with a propane shortage spurred by the cold weather, a temporary pipeline closure, and heavy propane demand for drying grain last fall. Walker's new executive order lifts weight limits and hour restrictions through April 26th. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst.
One of our listeners tells us that her tomato sauce tastes better when she makes it while listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. If WPR makes your life better in too many ways to count, make a special gift by becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle with a gift of $100 a month or more. Call 800-383-9772 or visit us online at WPR.org. And thank you.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Steep & Brew, a Wisconsin coffee roaster dedicated to delivering truly fresh, premium coffee to your grocer. Coffee roasted today is delivered within 72 hours. Steep & Brew, coffee done right. Online at steepandbrew.com.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We continue our conversation with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison College and Central Time's resident historian. We're talking about the history of voting rights and Election Day access in the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. What do you think was a key moment or change in the nation's election laws? Do you have questions about it? You can call in and join that conversation at 800-642-1234. In fact, we're going to dive right into the calls right now with Scott from Wisconsin Rapids. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you. Great topic. So I'm wondering, you know, we listened to the guest talk about how all these poll taxes and these obstacles that were put in front of people back in the 19th century, here we are in the 21st century doing the same thing again, albeit not as dramatic, but we're itching our way closer and closer. We got one side of the political aisle saying there's all kinds of corruption or voter ID that we need voter ID for, but clearly there's not corruption going on. And yet, why don't they just call it what it is and say they're trying to limit people from voting for a certain party? And, you know, maybe I might respect them more. But this whole issue, it seems we're creeping right back to where we were. And I guess that apparently is fine for some of the electorate, and I don't understand that.
Well, Scott, thanks for that call. Jonathan Pollack, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the differences, and I hope in the calls that come through, we have a chance to go through similarities and differences and continuity and change. I think one of the differences is that I think the caller was onto something, that the efforts to restrict the vote were much more overt back in the late 19th century. For example, in 1884, after a coalition of white Republicans who had come south and African-Americans had gotten a majority in the Virginia state legislature, in the 1884 elections, white vigilante groups took out full-page ads in newspapers warning black voters that if they attempted to vote, they'd be shot. So this is like there's no mistaking this.
It's
this
pretty,
is completely,
pretty overt.
Completely overt. And voter ID, I mean, here in Wisconsin, it's this kind of strange mixture of things. Because on the one hand, where governors often, when there's a piece of legislation they're especially eager to have passed, and it's a big live issue that's been resolved, they'll have a big signing ceremony, they'll invite people, they'll distribute official pens and so forth. And our governor is very quiet about signing the voter ID laws that the legislature just passed. But at the same time, given all the possible issues that confront our state this year, Governor Walker has said that as the court cases wind their way through, if they in some way find that the voter ID laws enacted are not okay, that he wants to call the legislature back in a special session to resolve voter ID, indicating this is hugely important. So it's really it's really hard to call this one. You know, is it you know, does that count as like an overt signaling about voter ID?
But is this something that you would have seen as recently as 10 years ago, though? I mean,
well, 10 years ago, 10 years ago is when the voter ID campaign kind of began. Alberto
Maybe
Gonzalez
that,
and the Bush administration kind of called on attorneys general around the United States to find voter fraud and root it out. And there was a great deal of money spent on this. Attorneys general who or people working for the U.S. Attorney General's office who didn't find voter fraud were kind of called on the carpet and asked why they weren't looking hard enough and accused of covering up. But nothing really turned up. I mean, there were a handful of cases here and there generally involving people who cast an absentee ballot and then voted, or people who owned multiple properties and voted at their summer home address and their winter home address. But yeah, all along the campaign for voter ID, one of the differences is it's been much more quiet for the most part, and it's only very recently that even the Democrats, the party who seems most affected by these laws if they come to pass, the Democrats from President Obama on down have been really vocal about it.
We're talking about voting rights today. Putting it in historical perspective, do you have a question for us? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to Jamie. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. I was wondering, would the guest be willing to answer what suggestions he feels might work well to add to the U.S. Constitution as an amendment to actually instill voting rights something that's not a privilege, something that should be guaranteed. And also, whether or not that's even passable.
All right, Jamie, thanks for that. Quite a load of questions there for you. I do think, you know, the election laws kind of vary from state to state, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so the way that we administer that so much of the responsibility for administering elections falls to the states, I think would make any constitutional amendment kind of difficult to put in there. I do know there's a group that's been circulating, or a few members of Congress have been circulating like a draft of a right to vote amendment to the Constitution. And I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it's relatively short and concise. And it says that states shall not enact anything that impinges on the right to vote or something like that. So on the one hand, it seems like that would do the job. On the other hand, I can envision that, you know, the word impinges or whatever they use, restricts, whatever term that is, that would be, you know, the subject of much debate and efforts to interpret that narrowly or interpret it broadly. The right to vote. So, you know, we currently exclude various classes of people from voting, people under the age of 18. People in prison in most states, in many states, people who've committed felonies even after they've served the term. So does that negate those laws? Does it, you know, what happens to that? I mean, if I were more of a constitutional scholar, and if that were more my area, more the present, I'd have a better idea on how you could write a more foolproof amendment. But at this, you know, given my knowledge base, that's the best I can do is to point up the, you know, what's out there and the difficulties those things face.
Well, Jamie, thanks for that question. And one question comes to mind, though, is looking over the history of voting. It sounds like a lot of it driven by passionate political views, driven by issues related to people from different races and stuff. But what about technology? I mean, are there other examples in history where technology raised questions about voting? Like, for example, the absentee ballot stuff and, you know, things of that
sort.
Yeah,
so, to be honest, I don't – I can't call up the history of absentee ballots right now.
Right.
But what I can think of, what sort of a technology that came up is the first of all, the rise of the secret ballot, which was an Australian import in the late 19th century.
It's Australian.
The Australian ballot was the original name of the secret ballot. So one of the things also to consider about voting then before, and I think that kind of came in like the 1870s, 1880s. So before that, voting was super public. You know, you've got two boxes. You know, if you've got two candidates running for an election, you've got two boxes. And you drop your card in the box, and it's a matter of public record. Anybody who's hanging around the courthouse or the whatever the polling place is that day knows exactly who put their card in which box.
And so was the secret ballot adopted because that kept some people from voting? Or?
Yeah, because it led to all kinds of coercion in the process. You know, you've got most people who vote have some sense of the political climate in their area, and if they went for the Democratic candidate in a Republican area or vice versa. And you've got people who are known to be members of the majority party kind of sitting there like, you know, drumming a billy club on their hand while you're voting. This is seriously intimidating the voter.
So the
secret ballot kind of undermined that whole process. But then that opened up the question, well, are people stuffing the ballot boxes? How do we know, if it's a secret, how do we know who actually voted? So in a sense, that's like a very small T kind of technology that came in that had questions about its adaptation.
Let's go to one more call. Dennis, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. I'm just calling in. When we talk about the voter ID debate, it's often talk about whether or not there's fraud going on. And I think the bigger issue for me anyways is, the voter turnout on off years is relatively low. And the feeling I get when I go there is, boy, wouldn't it be easy for anyone to say they're me? And, their chances of getting away with that is pretty good, especially in these off-year elections.
All right, Dennis, thanks for that question.
Well, I mean, that's certainly been the rationale for voter ID. And the thing I find kind of problematic about that idea is that, what's the payoff? What's the payoff and what's the risk? The risks for voter impersonation are pretty big. I mean, the cases of voter fraud that we've seen, the person who was registered at one address and voted at a different one and took a photo of her ballot and put it on Facebook and such, that's a pretty serious violation there. And it's for what? I mean, people will take chances to get a large amount of money for short-term use, but voting's pretty abstract. So We haven't found evidence of that going on in large numbers. That's why I have a hard time believing that it actually does or that people would want to do it.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for a lively discussion about a topic. We really appreciate it.
Thank you once again.
All right. Thanks a lot. Jonathan Pollack is a history instructor at Madison College.